You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Michael Sullivan, welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks so much for having me, man. Really grateful to be here.
Pumped to talk to you. I think it's been interesting observing your coverage and your particular analytical niche, which is sentiment analysis within Bitcoin. And I think a lot of what you've been putting out there has been confirming my natural pattern recognition indicators that have been going off in my mind, having been around Bitcoin for 13 years now. And I've been saying pretty frequently over the last few months that this market reminds me more of 2015 than any other bear market that I've experienced. And for those who are unaware, 2015 was terrible sentiment-wise. Bitcoin Twitter didn't even really exist yet, but the small pocket that did exist basically went away. People thought Bitcoin was legitimately going to die. For some reason or another, this time around in 2026, the sentiment's very similar, and I find it fascinating because I've never been more bullish, but people are really butthurt about where Bitcoin is right now.
It's so true. And this happened like really naturally for me. I was really into language and just kind of had been noticing relatively recently how kind of the vibes were out there changing and whatnot. And I'm so excited to talk to you about it because like, some of the people that have been here longer have been more in tune with this, at least from my experience. Like they've really been like optimistic in different ways than the newer folks are. And there's a bunch of potential reasons for that. I have my own theories as to why this might be. I'm sure you do too. Like between like gold ripping, the AI trade going crazy, and then like Bitcoin treasury companies burning a ton of the newer cohort of Bitcoiners. Like there's a lot of different reasons out there, but for whatever of them, like sentiment is really bad right now, despite so many things being so optimistic broadly. And that's just a really interesting dynamic. So yeah, I've been really, really, really having a ton of fun getting into this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we could dive deep into the details, but just a couple comments based off of that is thinking back to like FTX, when we went down to 15K, 15.5K, wherever we settled at the capitulation wick there, there wasn't like an AI trade like sucking or a gold or silver trade that people could point at in parallel and be like, oh, look how great they're doing compared to how poor we're doing. And I think this time around with the AI trade, gold and silver, even though they're off their highs, they're still relatively elevated. I think people are looking like, ah, God, am I holding the wrong bag? And beginning to basically do the meme of the stick figure poking Bitcoin and saying, do something.
Yeah, I think part of it too is like Bitcoiners in general are relatively technologically savvy and optimistic folks. And like we've really gotten deep into AI, myself very much included in that. So to watch something that we're, it just like to watch that narrative and that technological thing get really taken over and be so enthusiastic and euphoric, I think just hits a little bit differently since we're also generally so much aligned with the AI thing in general.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about, before we hit record, but the AI energy is real within Bitcoin too. I mean, I've been leaning into it very heavily here at TFTC and other aspects. And I think it's actually helped us to get good information as it pertains to Bitcoin out there. So it's been a net positive. But there are many people saying like, what are you doing focused on AI? You got to focus on Bitcoin. It's like, yeah, you can do both and hopefully leverage one to accelerate what you're doing with the other, which is leverage AI tools to accelerate Bitcoin education for our purposes here at TFTC. But it's fascinating. And I think now's a good time. Just like, how did you get into, I mean, you mentioned a love of language and all that. How did you get into sentiment analysis within Bitcoin specifically? And what sent you down this particular rabbit hole?
Yeah, so a little bit of background on myself. I've been an engineer for like 13 years, a writer for something like 9 or 10 now. Came into Bitcoin around 2021 for a lot of the same reasons that people did around that time with like money printing going crazy and that sort of thing. And just went immediately crazy deep down the rabbit hole. I was a big writer at the time and was so just like profoundly inspired by Bitcoin that I had this creative energy around it. Got deep into writing, and a lot of people in the Bitcoin space know me as the guy who was writing a Bitcoin novel. I did that, went really well, it was a ton of fun. But like upon wrapping that up, I was so like energized for wanting to build more stuff in the Bitcoin community. And at the time, like people were at each other's throats. I think it was like when I really started doing a lot of thinking about this was like late January, early February, when price was down there. And once again, saw this pattern that I've been seeing repeatedly of people like just butting heads when price was down for really no other reason other than price being down. I was like, I always wanted to explore this more deeply because I've been obsessed with language for a long time. I think it's fascinating how narratives kind of flow through systems. Like, you'll hear somebody go on a podcast, state an idea, and then it just proliferate across the entire Bitcoin ecosystem. I think that was fascinating. And I think minor language choices that people make hold a lot more information than most people realize. Like, there's these subtle kind of things that you can say to one another that actually give high degrees of indication, like what the underlying emotions are in people. And like, it's a really weird thing, like analyzing human emotion for this, like analytically about data. But I'd always like had these collection of different ideas and I wanted to pursue it farther. So I kind of started with just myself. I use like my engineering skill set to digest tons of my Twitter data, then throw every single tweet I'd ever done through these AI models to help like delineate what kind of language cues existed inside of them. And what I found was really interesting. Like, I've said a lot of dumb stuff on Twitter over the years. I both posted tops like people do, you know, like come to this thing and have different opinions, emotions, and are inspired by whatever narrative's out there. But looking at it in that way was like really eye-opening for me of how interesting of a tool this was just immediately for my own person. And I did it for other people, did it for Michael Saylor, started looking at this stuff. And then I just kept going and going and going, and like hundreds and hundreds of hours spent on this now, like cohorting different people, seeing what things different folks are talking about, what moods are being felt in different subsets of the Bitcoin ecosystem. And it's just been amazingly interesting to explore. Like, kind of all over the place, but that's sort of like the initial like evolution here for me. And I've just never been more excited about it. Cause even like presently right now with the most recent sell-offs, there's been some really fascinating stuff happening that I'm pretty pumped to share about.
Yeah, I guess let's jump into it. I mean, talking about like cohorts and different cohorts and the sentiment that may exist in one or across many, and diving into the language, like discerning sentiment, you said like the word choice is very important, and the particular words you use says a lot more than the short sentence you may include those words in. What is the sort of minutia of deriving specific sentiment from word choice?
So fortunately, people way smarter than myself have solved these problems in pretty clear ways. The quickest way to like maybe conceptualize it, like every single different emotion has different words that are more or less likely to be used around it. And like, for example, one of my favorite ones is like conviction, to look at conviction over time, how confident people are and those kind of things. And this one's easier to conceptualize because you can basically just search for words like would or maybe or these kind of things that just are indicative of like slightly more hedging. The inverse of that would be like really confident things like going to 100K tomorrow, like just like a lot of exclamation marks, other things. And basically people have trained these models through Twitter data, which is why it's particularly interesting to look at that stuff, to recognize how much like optimism or anger or different moods exist comparatively over time. And then what I do is I take that initial measurement and then compare it to every single tweet a user has ever said or every single post, and then look at how that deviates over time. Because that's what's really interesting, is not just like seeing, okay, people are really mad about this all at once. It's most interesting to see like how their language evolves, when they get angrier, what events they get angry around, what kind of narratives they're talking about while they're getting angry, and then how these moods collide. So like conviction is interesting on its own, but it's also really fascinating when it's like people are really convicted and really optimistic, which typically happens around blow off tops and that kind of thing. So looking at all that and then doing it for different cohorts has been crazy. We can take it wherever you want on the which one you want to do. But like, since we were just speaking about AI, that might be a decent first one to just like look at how this narrative has taken over the entire Bitcoin ecosystem.
Yeah, let's do that. Because it is objectively true, like I said earlier. And I think it's actually like a breath of fresh air. Personally, while you pull this up, I'll just ramble here. But breath of fresh air for me. It's like, oh, something interesting to learn more about, to apply, to stay on the cutting edge of things and hopefully apply it to what we're doing here.
Yeah, so I very much share that sentiment with you too. I'm using these tools like absolute crazy, at a crazy rate. And I'm using it to build this stuff for Bitcoiners too, like to your point earlier, where to build this suite of things, like I would have had to have a full team of people and like tons and tons of time, like money, like to be able to do this using my own like compute, basically. It's just been really freeing how much crazy stuff you can build with these tools. It's a profound game changer for how we work, in my opinion. What we're looking at here is the amount that AI, just the phrase AI, is mentioned over time. Specifically, though, it's among Bitcoiners, which I think is the interesting dynamic, where like we all kind of recognize that AI is this frequent narrative talked about in the world. It's like kind of defining 2026 in a lot of ways. And I mean, even this longer period. But what was so cool to me was watching the Bitcoin community talk about it. And you can kind of see it like gyrate over time. Like there's like new headlines will release. People talk about it at a higher rate, then it'll lose interest a little bit. But it's pretty obvious to see here, like this is a very consistent, powerful trend, despite there being small little euphoric peaks among the Bitcoin community. Like this is just a growing mind share happening out there. And I think this really confirms a lot of the stuff that we were talking about, where it's like drawing a lot of mind share away from Bitcoin. And that's clearly even happening within the Bitcoin community.
Yeah. And I'd actually be interested to see this Bitcoin cohort overlaid with others, because I was having conversations about this with some Bitcoiners, and I feel like, I mean, could be wrong, but I feel like we hopped on the AI trend earlier than most, because I think, what does that say about Bitcoiners, tech forward, early adopters, willing to take risks? Like my assumption is that the Bitcoin cohort would, like on a per capita basis, for lack of a better term, would be like much higher involvement and engagement with AI compared to others outside of obviously the AI cohort itself in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts about this, but when I was in Vegas for Bitcoin 2026, like one of the main things I was talking about was AI. That was the panel that I was on. And for me, it feels as though like Bitcoin kind of prepped me in some ways to adopt AI more quickly. For me, Bitcoin was kind of this like ego disillusionary thing where I was wrong about it repeatedly before getting into it. I'd had exposure to it multiple years before taking it much more seriously in 2021. For me, like the repeatedly being wrong about a technology, then like kind of spending more time in Bitcoin and growing more optimistic about technology broadly, I do think primed me in a lot of ways. Where with AI, I felt a similar thing, where like when it was just coming out, I was a very early adopter of the tools the entire time. But during that time, I remember saying things like, oh, AI is not going to totally take over this domain, or like I'll still have to be involved in that part of the process, or like, no, I need to review this area of the code. That's something I need to understand deeply as the human. And I've continually had to walk every single one of those statements back over and over and over again and just accept that like this is a new paradigm that's kind of happening. And like, I don't know where it's all going to go, but I think going through that in the Bitcoin space around that new evolving technology kind of primed me to adopt the AI tools more quickly. And it's part of the reason that so many of us are so interested in this thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely it. I mean, I think for Bitcoin, for me, when I found it, I was very receptive to a Bitcoin-like solution at the time that I found Bitcoin. So I personally had like very little doubt when I found it. I was also very young. I was 21 and probably a bit naive, which worked out to my benefit. But I found Bitcoin and I was like, oh, this is it. This is like, because I was a child of the 2008 financial crisis, like going into college right as that was going on. And studying economics, basically being like, all right, how did it get this bad? Like, I need to figure this out. And having a sort of innate feeling that the incumbent financial system and banking system and monetary system was corrupt. And so I found Bitcoin, which at the time, you had Andreas Antonopoulos and others, a few others educating about it, and that whole digital native currency for the internet that can't be controlled by governments or central banks clicked with me and dove in and tried to learn as much as possible about the tech side of it, the protocol side of it, and how it works, how to receive, how to send, how mining works, and became obsessed with it. And obviously I'm here now. I've basically made a career out of continuing to follow the space and help develop it. And I don't know, for me personally, it was like, oh, I found it and I dove right in. I imagine there were similar feelings for many others. Obviously, there's many who found it, dismissed it, came back, and then ultimately said, all right, I was wrong. So I think you have two archetypes there, like the tech forward, hyper crazy experimenters, like, oh no, yeah, this makes sense. And then you have the other archetype, which is maybe initially skeptical, but a small enough ego to get over any apprehensions or skepticism that existed before, and to hold your hand up and say, hey, I was wrong. I should learn more about this and dive in. So when it comes to AI, I think I was very similar. I mean, we've been using AI here at TFTC for over 2 years, which I think is probably like 2024 is when we started using AI like to help the operations and to run the business. And it's only got like the tools have only gotten exponentially better throughout those 2 years. And I feel very fortunate that we started experimenting with this 2 years ago, because now it feels like as new stuff drops, it's like, okay, we've had enough swings at the plate to understand what to adopt, what to ignore, and how to implement things once they come to market. And I feel like it was a no-brainer for us in terms of AI too. It's like, hey, this new thing is pretty powerful. Yeah, it may not be perfect, but it's probably going to be a large part of the digital economy moving forward. So it makes sense to adopt it early and figure it out. So you have a head start there. And it's fun too. That's the other thing.
Very much so. I also don't think it's the entire story either. Like there is other reasons potentially the Bitcoin sentiment feels low. It's just like one of the many variables. It's like, it's so multifaceted. And one of the things exploring this is like Bitcoin is fragmented in a lot of ways too, where it's not just like single groups. Like the longer the network has been around, the more isolated different groups have been, which have different narratives they latch onto about why things are doing things. And that's been kind of interesting. I've also seen like one of the things I'll pull up here momentarily is the like engagement on social media from like some of the Bitcoiner accounts that have been around a while. So like, yeah, like newer retail folks, plebs have been tweeting about certain things and angry, and we can get to that. But like even in these older Bitcoin accounts that have been around for quite a long time, like we're still seeing similar rates of this. So I'll just share this here. This is the specifically like the Bitcoin price on top. The middle is the optimism in the language of the OGs over time, the ones that I track in my system. And then the bottom one is the one that I want to draw attention to. That's really interesting to me. And it's the likes per post. So like it's adjusted. So like how much engagement are you getting on X comparatively to back in previous periods? And like the main thing that sticks out to me personally is that like end of 2022, beginning of 2023 bottom, where like the moods were relatively good still. Like there's like up and down with anger or whatever, but the engagement rate was super high. There was way more activity happening even back then comparatively to now during similar vibes, right? Like we're down quite a lot price-wise, but like back then there was just a distinctively different mood comparatively to where things are at right now.
Yeah. I agree. And like, while you're saying that too, I'm wondering if the quick and iterative algorithm changes at X affect us at all. Like because I think Nikita Bear came out at some point within the last year or two and explicitly said we're going to deprioritize anybody talking about crypto. Okay. And so I'm just trying to think of ways that the data could be not skewed, but missing that context. Have you looked into that at all?
Oh, it's so at the core of one of the ways I've done this is like very individualized. So the way that a lot of social sentiment has been done previously, things like the fear and greed, the way those tools work is they'll like have a couple different things that they pull in. But one of the main social sentiment things they pull in is like Reddit posts recently or like the top posts on Twitter at the time. And they'll just pull that into the system and they'll say like, all right, well, there's an increased amount of posts around this thing that indicates like higher levels of sentiment. And that's interesting. But I've always like felt that there was a little bit unexplored there. So I took like a different approach than that. A lot of those ways to measure sentiment, just like take the main posts out there, which get all these like massive engagement baiting accounts. These people that just like say dumb stuff to get engagement. There's tons of bots everywhere now. That's never been more of a problem. So you kind of get like a really polluted data set with those things. So I took the exact opposite. I went and individually found people that I know are real, like some anonymous, like a, or whatever. It doesn't really matter as much as like they're a person who can post consistently over time. And I've done some like validation that they're a real person tweeting consistently over a long duration. So you can kind of watch their actions over time. So you lose a little bit of that like algorithmic sway, where like we all kind of are filtered through the lens of what our algorithm is showing us. Like I guarantee you my algorithm is wildly different than yours compared to other people too. Like we're all seeing different things based on our interest. But the way we're interacting with those things can still hold a lot of data. Like as we'll get into the anger thing here relatively soon, I'm sure. But like if you are frequently having angry tweets out there, regardless of what the algorithm is showing you, like that's still a very interesting lens into the eyes of like those people that have been here for a while. So like you can really see like, there's increased levels of anger right now. Like it's, if it's because the algorithm's showing them more of that negative things or whatever, like the algorithms are designed to give you more of what you're searching for, more of what you desire. Like, and it, sometimes people like are disproportionately likely to click on rage bait if they're in specific moods, that kind of thing. And by looking at this through an individualized lens, you can kind of like see that stuff rather than just get this like broad data aggregation thing that existed in previous versions of the Fear and Greed Index.
So freaks, this report was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. Guys, things happen, things get lost. You need to replace your phone, life happens, and BitKey has been designed with this in mind. So if you're looking for the easiest way to secure your Bitcoin off the exchange, go get a BitKey. It doesn't come with any seed phrases. There's no single point of failure. It's a 2-3 multi-sig. You have your device, you have the mobile app, and Block stores a key in the server. So you have collaborative multi-sig there. On top of that, the new BitKey has a screen, so you can actually see and verify what you're approving. You can look at transactions, addresses, account changes. The difference between trusting and knowing has been built into the new BitKey with the screen. They've changed code delegation and other advanced features like inheritance, recovery. If you're looking to get your Bitcoin off exchange, you haven't done so, and you're looking for the easiest way to do that, go get a BitKey. You can use our code today, TFTC, to get 10% off the new BitKey. So go download the BitKey app, use the code TFTC to get 10% off the new BitKey, and start your self-custody journey today. This episode has been sponsored by our good friends at BitKey. All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No gains, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there, or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR for a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity. It's hard to beat. I mean, the duration in the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's aven.com/Bitcoin. Check it out.
Yeah. So let's dive further. Like how many people have you, I guess, indexed with the sentiment analysis? Am I on the list? How many, how do you determine whether somebody's an OG or a pleb? And what are some of like the more interesting, I don't know if you've feel comfortable picking out a particular account or a particular group of accounts and describing how their sentiment has changed or stayed consistent over a period of time, but really nailing into the different cohort construction, how you do it and what you're seeing this year particularly.
So the cohort construction ends up being by far the most important thing here. The like delineation there between like OGs is basically 10 years or more in Bitcoin and consistently posting. But there's some problems where you can't just like always say, like, pick a person and then use their data. There's a lot of like things behind the scenes and figuring out which data is most pertinent, which one's most useful, these kind of things. Like some people don't post for years at a time, and that kind of stuff is kind of tricky. Where I thought about this in a lot of ways, really similar to the way James Check does on-chain data. But there's a huge difference here in that like social sentiment tweets are wildly different than on-chain stuff, where like people can ghost for months at a time. So if you look at very specific individuals, and if you go through like my own tweets, like there might be periods for a month or two where you're not tweeting as much. The way to solve this problem in the like from the data perspective is you cohort people together. Like there's always going to be specific bits of noise. Like I had a child, so I'm like really excited about stuff. And like you can actually see when I'm having positive life events in my data. But if you get a big group of Bitcoiners together and look at the things they're talking about in aggregate, you actually get way more interesting stuff. Like as you can see when they're as a collective talking more about negative things, more about positive things. So I've used this much less to be like creepy on specific individuals and just like look through specific stuff, and way more to see like what different groups are doing. So a lot of my efforts have been like defining different groups, seeing which groups are more interesting. And a couple that I've logged into as being really fascinating are the older Bitcoiners versus the newer Bitcoiners, the plebs versus the OGs, retail, or whatever you want to call them, like newer accounts versus older ones. And like a lot of my time spent on this is figuring out who those folks are, seeing how long they've been in Bitcoin for, and then kind of comparing them to one another. So one of the ones that has been more interesting is the pub's anger levels, which is what we're looking at here. And I think, again, people kind of feel these things, right? Like it's not like it's a revolutionary new thing to say like, oh yeah, the plebs are really angry right now. But it's so interesting to me because sometimes you feel these things, but to be able to visualize how bad it actually is has been eye-opening to me, to get a better pulse on where stuff actually is. And as we're looking at here, there's like one of the longest, most persistent periods of negative emotion here, essentially, like persistent anger since like end of 2025.
Yeah, that's an insane chart. Who are they most mad at?
So that's an interesting thing too. So like again, fear and greed has always been this like one thing. You just get like fear, right? But there is a lot more complexity to humans than just like, oh, I'm in a bad mood, I'm in a good mood. Like different emotions have wildly different things. Like if you are fearful, it's very different than if you're angry, right? If people are angry, they're much more likely to make different kinds of mistakes. I wrote a long piece recently about this, like analogizing, like if you are in a car and somebody cuts you off, you're immediately like sort of building stories in your mind when you're under the influence of anger about like how stupid this person is. They have like different like opinions, or like you build up a whole thing. But this holds true through the lens of markets and Bitcoin too. Like when people are prices down, people are like pissed off about that, they're disproportionately likely to try to find villains out there to blame. And I think we're seeing that right now with the Saylor getting yelled at for selling 32 Bitcoins. Like what people desperately, desperately wanted somebody to blame for negative price action. So it's kind of just like this environment that breeds toxicity and then is just looking for somebody to latch onto and yell at. And it's kind of comical. But when you, the thing that's been valuable for me is like recognizing that people are just kind of on edge and kind of angry. And then as soon as somebody gets yelled at, like say, or it kind of has been a useful lens for me to be like, all right, people are really overreacting to this silly news right now, you know?
Yeah. It makes you wonder too. It is funny. What can you tell, or what have you tried to derive between the difference of sentiment from plebs to OGs? Because I think you said OGs are relatively more optimistic than plebs are. Now I've got some thoughts about that, which is, I think if you've been around Bitcoin for long enough, you realize like, hey, there's really nothing, you know, I want to say nothing, but it's basically Bitcoin's a beast that beats to its own drum, and you have to internalize that, and you have to stop externalizing what's happening via the day-to-day price movements on people like Michael Saylor or other actors, institutions, core devs, whoever it may be. And I think it's fascinating that the plebs, as you've defined them in this cohort, are have been angrier for longer than they ever have been in recent memory, at least going back to 2023.
So this is maybe the thing I'm most excited to talk to you about, because you like locked onto it there already. Like, this is arguably my angriest cohort. It's also across other metrics too. Like, they're much more pessimistic in general. The OGs are not as overly angry right now. Moods are still not amazing, but there is for sure like a huge deviation happening. So in order to get all this data, I need to run these tweets and things through a bunch of AI compute. So it's not a super quick process. Like, I don't get all this stuff and immediately have all the information. Like, there's a whole like giant pipeline that I've built to get all this stuff right. So after the most recent sell-off, I was really excited to see like, okay, what is happening here to the sentiment? Because I collaborated with James Check on a piece called Peak Apathy like a couple weeks back, talking about how like moods were so persistently just like no one cares right now, right? I think many of us have felt that. But after this recent sell-off, perhaps the time pain capitulation, which he calls it, but I was so fascinated to see like how moods had changed. So I immediately just began my pipeline, threw everything through it, just like looked at it in detail. And what stuck out to me was like, there is the divergence that was beginning has continued to grow, both across anger levels and optimism between the OGs and the plebs, and conviction, which is maybe the most interesting deviation happening, where the plebs' conviction was pretty high, which conviction is a kind of a tricky thing to reason about. I can share my chart here so we have something else to like think through. But conviction in general, it's kind of like a non-directional metric where you can be really convicted for different reasons, right? Like, you can be convicted because things are bad, or that bad things are going to happen, or you can be convicted that good things are going to happen. It's sort of all over the place. It's really this, it's in combination with other moods and things that are happening where it gets really interesting. What we're looking at here is the average conviction level in plebs language over time comparatively to Bitcoin price. And you'll see that they were very convicted here since the top, right? Like, with growing conviction, this right side here with the higher amount of like gold compared to blue. But they were also angry at the time, lots of negative emotions. They've been like highly convicted that bad things were going to happen. But recently their conviction has totally fallen off. The OGs, on the other hand, relatively similar moods in a lot of ways, but the conviction has done the opposite thing. They've grown much more convicted around this bottom compared to all the plebs. And to me, it just speaks volumes to how much a little bit of experience matters, where like, and this is where I'm so curious to hear your thoughts about, because like, you've been here before, you've seen this before. Like, do you not disproportionately think like that experience has given you a different lens to think about this compared to all these new folks who are so scared right now?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I mean, like I said, the pattern recognition, I think. So I got into Bitcoin like late 2013, and my first buy was like top ticking that bull market right before Mt. Gox completely collapsed. And then I wrote it down all the way to 2015, where the capitulation wick was topped out at like $1,400 in late 2013, early 2014. Then over the course of 18 months, felt like $200 wicked down to like 180 at one point, I believe, in like July of 2015. Like I said earlier, the sentiment then was terrible. Then we began to climb back in late 2016, then rolling into 2017. 2017 was one of those surreal years in Bitcoin, probably the most surreal, even outside of 21 and last year. I would say 17 was probably the most euphoric I've experienced. And then, but I do think, I mean, I was writing about it and talking about it a lot on the podcast in the very early days, right when it started, but like the ICO bubble, it was like obvious that was a bubble, and there was some animal spirits pushing the markets up in that era. And then you had the fork wars as well. I think that's why, particularly for hardcore Bitcoiners, that was an era of relative euphoria, because you had this massive sort of block size war culminate with a legitimate like sort of confrontation at the social distributed consensus layer, and depending on who you talk to. I like to think that the good guys won, and that's very validating for many people who were around back then. I was like, oh wow, this thing's truly distributed. It's truly run by individuals who decided to run code. So yeah, 2017 was very euphoric. And obviously 2018, 2019, it was a bear market, but it was just more boring from my recollection. There was a lot of building going on. There was a Lightning Network was getting more robust. And I think, Block, formerly Square, coming in, really validating it, around that time as well. I mean, I think they launched Bitcoin buys, right after like the blow off top of 2017, but like having Jack Dorsey and Square sort of validate and spin up Spiral and everything else that they did was like a nice sort of strong anchor indicator. Like, hey, we're not crazy. One of the most prolific tech founders in the world is validating this. And then obviously you had then you had 2020 COVID, and you had that March 12th and March 15th, sort of 50% drop overnight. And everybody's like, whoa, that's crazy. But I think rather quickly people were able to read the tea leaves of what was going to go on with COVID, which was massive money printing. And then we had the run up over the next 2 years. And then the Fed started raising rates, and that sucked a lot of liquidity out. And then FTX happened shortly after the Fed started hiking rates, and you had that. And that was more... that sentiment was more like, hey, there's more bad actors, like ICO bubble part two, with a bunch of sort of easy to call out grifters if you have anything that resembles a bullshit meter. So I think a lot of people, the anger there was like, hey, there's a bunch of grifters shitting in the punch bowl and ruining it for the rest of us. And then you have that roll into 23. In 24, with the ETFs and the government sort of validating Trump running as the Bitcoin president, the crypto president. And I think a lot of people, rightly so, are like, all right, the U.S. government is here. That sort of tail risk of government shutdown of Bitcoin may be off the table. Run it up to wherever it did, 126. And then, I think that is... where a lot of the divergence, I think, stems from, and particularly if you come in at like 2017, or not in 2017, if you came in at like 2020 and onward, I can imagine a lot of people being like 5 or 6 years in, be like, wait a second, we were supposed to go up forever. The government's on our side. The ETFs are here. Gold's ripping, silver ripping, AI is ripping. Like, why are we selling off? And then, you mentioned James Check earlier. I think he's done a good job of reading the on-chain data. And I think there was a ton of people who held Bitcoin for 10 to 15 years and were saying, hey, I'm going to take some chips off the table, sold into six-figure Bitcoin. And then obviously on top of that, you have just the natural sort of liquidity flows going out of Bitcoin after it hit a new all-time high into these higher growth opportunities in AI and temporarily in precious metals, but I think more so in AI. And now we're sitting here 50% down. People are wondering, when's our time coming? I thought we were going the hyper Bitcoinization. Hand up. I was one of those guys who was saying on the podcast, I was like, I could squint and see like super cycle coming. And as soon as the tides turn, I mean, I know I've been around long enough to know, like, all right, like, you're not going to, like, Bitcoin's going to do what it does. It beats to its own drum. And it's like, hand up, I was wrong. Seems like we got a typical 4-year cycle here. And now sentiment's in the shitter. I actually think, literally, within the last 2 weeks, it's beginning to turn. Because I think some OGs are, like, recognizing that sentiment is down bad and sort of trying to inject more optimism in the form of like, hey, remember why we're here in the first place. Like, we have this peer-to-peer distributed cash system with hard cap supply, can't be censored by governments. Look around. Do you think government censorship's rising or falling? It's rising. Look around. Do you think the government's going to need to print more money? Looking at debt levels and interest expense on debt, like, yeah, it looks like they're going to need to print more money. And so it's like, okay, if A, B, plus a number of other factors are true, then Bitcoin's reason for existing and its fundamental value prop are stronger than ever.
Yeah, I think there's something beautiful about sell-offs too that make people renew their theses around it and like remember the actual reason they're here. I feel like as though there were so many tourists that have been flushed out this entire time and kind of remembering the roots to which like what is truly profound about this technology. It's kind of a beautiful process despite it being a little bit painful. This chart here echoes the current divergence that you were just talking about, where this is same exact kind of chart measuring conviction and language over time, but this is for the OGs compared to the plebs. And you can see here, like there's been a lot of volatility in the past, but like OGs are disproportionately optimistic right now compared to the plebs who are disproportionately convicted right now comparatively to where the plebs were at, which was much less conviction. And this was like one of the more large convergences that I found. I just found this really interesting. To your point earlier about like the different narratives, like there's all these different things that people latch onto, like the 4-year cycle being dead, being a really big and super interesting one. All these different price levels that people latch onto. And they're basically stories that people are telling themselves all the time. Like I mentioned, I've been really into language. Like humans are kind of like story-driven creatures. We use stories as ways to like perceive the world, to think through things. Stories make their way around the Bitcoin ecosystem too. Like not always based on how truthful they are, but kind of like whatever the market's feeling at the time, if people are more optimistic, angry or whatever, and different stories get latched onto. Like one of the reasons I think this conviction thing is so fascinating is because one of the reasons conviction drops is because your story disintegrates. Like you felt as though this thing was a truth or like a certainty about how the world was going to function. And then you were wrong. And when that happens, like you start to like have to double like check on the things you're saying. You're not as confident comparatively to like to when your story is proven right. Not necessarily that's bullish or bearish, but just like you had a story that you thought defined the way the world worked. If you're proven more right about that story, you grow increasingly convicted. And that's why I think this is so interesting, because we had a bunch of different stories die here. And some stories we didn't want to have function, like the 4-year cycle that has continued. And I just think that kind of the different stories that different cohorts of people have told about Bitcoin have been really fascinating to watch through it this whole time.
So freaks, when you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about 1 out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold 2 keys, they hold 1 key. And it always takes 2 keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
What's up, freaks? This rip is brought to you by our good friends at CrowdHealth. I've been a happy CrowdHealth member for almost 5 years now. My wife and I have had 2 children while we've been on CrowdHealth, and I actually just got the last bill for our third child funded. It was $6,157. CrowdHealth negotiated down to $2,309, and we only paid $500. The rest was crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth Network. If you're sick of health insurance premiums and having to pay deductibles and getting ripped off at the hospital, join CrowdHealth. It's an alternative way to pay for your healthcare. It's not health insurance. It's crowdfunded healthcare. As you can tell, they negotiate prices for you. You pay in cash. It's much cheaper. Overall, we're much happier. They have incredible perks. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC to sign up. 5 years on CrowdHealth, not looking back. Joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC. Once you set up your account, you're going to get $99 a month for your subscription for the first 3 months.
Do you have the data on what exactly Bitcoiners are convicted on? Obviously, it's Bitcoin, but what sort of framing they're putting out there that is backing this conviction?
Well, different groups talk about different things. So like right now, a lot of the conviction I hear is similar things that you just said, where it's like, the money printing aspect, just like these fundamental long-term theses about Bitcoin that are like were so persuasive to me too, where it's like this thing, we're about to cross $40 trillion of debt. Like there's just all these long-term money printing issues that desperately need to be solved. And Bitcoin is just this brilliant solution to those things. Very much come out more, at least like I've seen more of them happening currently. The thing I mentioned with different groups too, like there's like things that like Saylor just wrote this long piece about like different ideologies in Bitcoin. I've already started looking at the different people that he was talking about them. One of them he defined as Bitcoin capitalists. That group as a whole is convicted about totally different things than the other Bitcoiners are talking about. Like they're like preferred products they're putting out there and all these other things. Like those narratives are disproportionately talked about by that group of people, like STRC and SATA, et cetera. Whereas like the more technological Bitcoiners, people actually building stuff, are talking way more about different things. It's like eCash and like building new things. And like quantum is talked about more there. The AI thing is talked about much more frequently in that group of people too, which is kind of interesting. But those are the sorts of things that are different. And that's sort of what I meant earlier about like a divergence of Bitcoiners, like these different groups that are almost more siloed. And because of the X algorithms kind of breaking us into different chunks, they're not even interacting with each other as much as they may have been in the past, which kind of farther exacerbates this like different little echo chambers that are all sort of segmented. And that's just a crazy different dynamic that happens way more now that probably hasn't quite as much previously.
Yeah. I mean, I remember back in the day on Bitcoin Twitter back in like 2015, 2016, when it really, like towards the end of 2015, 2016, when it really started picking up, when the fork wars like started rumbling, and there was no algo back then. It was all chronological. TweetDeck was like the thing. So I would just build list of people. Like I would personally create my own algos of list of people, and I have a Bitcoin list. You can go to my ex profile and find it. I've been building it since I think 2013, maybe 2014. But for the longest time, it was just like chronological order of the conversations happening on that list were how I consumed content about Bitcoin. And when they took my baby that is TweetDeck behind the shed and shot its brains out, it really disrupted my my information flow for many years there. I felt like I was plugged into the matrix. And to your point, yeah, the algos, I mean, it's very obvious that they're siloing. I mean, it's not just Bitcoiners, anybody. Like I know now how to manipulate the algo in my favor. Like if I notice that it's making me angry, it's like, all right, let me go find somebody talking about AI or somebody talking about something positive or somebody doing like golf demos, like, you know, so like golf coaches showing swing demos, and like go like some of those tweets. So I get more optimism and signal injected into my feed. But I mean, I think it's obvious once you notice how the algorithm works and reacts to what you're interacting with, is it like you get siloed immediately into what you're interacting with.
Mm-hmm. And you just showed more and more and more of it. And like I've noticed, especially after negative news events, like if there's some really bad news item that comes out there and I engage with it at all, just because I wanted to keep up with the world, I am just given more and more and more and more of that negative content. And you literally have to be conscious about it and try to have it not shoved down your throat by the algorithms. And it's a complex subject, because like I'm very grateful for the algorithms in other ways. Like so much of the Bitcoin community that I know, I've like came to have some really fantastic friends. And in some ways, those have been like algorithmically driven friendships, in the sense where like I had some hobby I was into and we connected with it and ended up because of the algorithm, right? But at the same time, it's so toxic when you're sent down this like negative rabbit hole and somebody's spiraling on a topic, and the thing they probably need is to have no more of that fed to them automatically, but it's just like shoved down their throat. So it's a weird world we live in. I feel that the old just regular social feed days, you just scroll and get the entire history, was so amazing in some ways. And I definitely have some nostalgia for that time for sure.
Yeah. One thing I forgot to mention earlier that I think could contribute to the conviction and the sentiment, the diverging sentiment, even though OGs are still relatively angry compared historically, but compared to plebs, less angry, And obviously, as we can see on this chart, more convicted than plebs are, who seem to be losing conviction right now. I think a lot of that has to do with like how long you've been in Bitcoin and what that means for like the value of the Bitcoin that you hold. So like anybody's gotten in at 2021, particularly if you got in like later that year. I'm just trying to pull up a chart to make sure I'm accurate on these on these numbers. But yeah, if you got in like 2021 and the price of Bitcoin ran up to 60 and you've been in it for 5 years and you look up and we're at 63,000, I can see why a lot of people are like, oh, this is not what I thought it was, but right where I was 5 years ago. And obviously that runs with the assumption that you bought the top and never bought again. I mean, if you DCA'd every 2 weeks during that period, I think you're still up pretty dramatically, considering the bear market of 22 and 23. But I think there is this sort of people put the mental flag down of like, I got into Bitcoin in April 2021. It was trading at $60,000. And now it's like, oh, it's June of 2026. And it's trading at $63,000. And people are like, what? What did I get? Is it really happening? Is this thing actually valuable?
It just goes to prove like the value of DCA and consistency rather than like that just YOLOing all your money in at the top. What's like tricky though is like when you look at some of these like measures of sentiment and optimism and things, like people are so convicted at tops. They're so optimistic at tops. So they disproportionately make terrible decisions when that happens. And I'm not saying this through the lens of like somebody who's an expert at it either. Like I looking through some own data with this, like I'm guilty of both of these things. And I think that's extremely common, especially when people come into Bitcoin, because price is basically the biggest advertisement, right? Like that's the thing that gets most people initially. Like no matter how you want to feel about it, like human greed is a really powerful emotion that draws people towards seeing these things. And it's usually after that price advertisement that you begin to learn, go down the rabbit hole, so to speak, and just like do the whole thing and learn how profoundly impactful this technology can be. But very few people at least hear about Bitcoin at first because of those things. It's almost always the price that draws people in, which is happening typically when people are optimistic and euphoric and highly convicted.
Yeah. How do we use this sentiment data? What is your hope by surfacing this data and synthesizing it and making people aware of it? Like, is there anything actionable from all this, do you think?
So I for sure think so, but I'm glad you asked this because I have a lot of people that see it and they're like, all right, man, how can I trade on this? I'm like, that's not really my interest around it. Like the way I think about it is just to have a more accurate lens of where things are at, where literally just seeing some of these things for me personally has been valuable. Where if I feel as though I've been more optimistic the more I've looked at it because I see that people are angry. And like to just be in your own little algorithmic silo, like we were talking about, and feeling angry is very different than if you see like, okay, the broader Bitcoin community is pretty pissed off right now. Even if you don't know what they're pissed off at, even if like they're talking about different things than you, just like seeing that, like, all right, everybody is angry right now. That means that people are disproportionately likely to believe stupid shit and they're more likely to like make bad decisions or want people to blame for stuff. So whenever you see people blaming Saylor for a price sell-off because they sold 32 Bitcoin, like maybe fade that narrative a little bit. Like don't feel quite as fearful because you can see that other people feel that way. That's sort of the lens that I'm looking through things on, or the other side of that being like if people are optimistic and really highly convicted, like maybe be a little bit cautious or not think that we're going to have like a new paradigm thing. Like it's just a useful lens to be a little bit more like practical, perhaps. It's not going to like predict to the perfect T like some future price, but I think it's a really good way to like make sure you have a good knowledge of where things are at and don't get too wrapped up in whatever dumb story is getting thrown around Twitter at the time and just being able to have a little bit more accurate lens of where things are going.
Yeah. No, but I'm thinking like your comments about storytelling earlier, like, is there something, because I'm conscious about this, obviously, just the nature of what I do here on the podcast and in the newsletter and on X to a certain extent too, is effect. Like that's something I've been fascinated with too, affecting narrative. And it's something I became extremely fascinated with about 8 years ago when I was working Great American Mining, and we were dealing with like the ESG narrative headwinds and basically positioning Bitcoin mining as sort of good for energy systems, good for humanity, good for human flourishing, actually counterintuitive to the broader public who thinks that we're wasting energy. It's like, well, no, actually we're being extremely energy efficient by utilizing energy assets that are otherwise stranded or just completely wasted. And we're actually helping bolster the economics of utilities and grid systems so they can reinvest. And then on top of that, like highlighting how objectively absurd the concept of ESG is. And I think, you know, whether people want to admit it or not, Bitcoin miners or people commenting on the Bitcoin mining industry in that period of time did have a positive effect in terms of helping people come to realize that ESG was completely asinine. Mm-hmm. And so on that note, like using and recognizing where sentiment and conviction may be at any given point in time and using that as a trigger, not maybe as a buy, but as like a reframing and a reinvigoration of the fundamentals, which is, I think, in the last month specifically is really what I've been focusing on. It's like, okay, what's going on outside of Bitcoin that is going to drive people to Bitcoin? You look at the Strait of Hormuz, you look at the weaponization of the incumbent financial and monetary system. Like, it's like, hey, they're preventing people from accessing their assets. And it's even happening on stablecoin rails now too. Like, if you think, if you approach it unemotionally, yes, you may not agree with anybody or everybody that's using Bitcoin or any one entity that's using Bitcoin, but you have to admit that Bitcoin, due to its design, can be used by anybody. And if it can be, and they're being shut out from other means of payment or value storage, like, they're going to find Bitcoin useful. And that is bullish. But again, going back to storytelling narrative and using the sentiment and conviction data that you've aggregated to sort of trigger like an alarm that says like, hey, get the good why we're here content out or something like that.
There's a lot of different stuff here. This is a fun one. But like, there's all sorts of different stories that get told out there. And I think what can be really interesting about this is like how the story is told under the context of some of these other things, right? Like, one of the more interesting ones to me was looking at like the strategic Bitcoin reserve as a story and how it aligned with other emotions and price too, right? Like, when price was ripping at the end of 2024, people were talking about the strategic Bitcoin reserve, and there was actually forward movement on it too with the government, right? Like, it was a thing. But the narrative out there was it was going to be this persistent nation state buyer, and it was just going to be like, crazy euphoric bull run because of it, right? And it's kind of funny that like it was specifically when people were the most optimistic that that narrative took off, right? And presently, there is movement on the strategic Bitcoin reserve. Like, there's stuff happening out there. There is continued action. But what's crazy is the mention rate is just zero. Like, it is very infrequently talked about. There's like Scott Bessent was just out there talking about it as well. Mm-hmm. And that thing, that tweet about it, the videos about it, that got almost no traction. If that same thing happened back at the end of 2024, that would have been like way up there. Everybody would have watched John say this thing is happening. And I think it's really interesting looking at the same story under the context of like really optimistic regimes versus more fearful, angry ones, where people just don't take these stories as seriously, where they're like underweighting the probability of this. It's still all kind of like probabilistic. Anything could happen. We could have massive sell-offs because something crazy happens over in the Middle East, or we could have some positive news that breaks. It's just like impossible to really know future stuff in that manner, right? But it is, I think, useful to think like, what kind of stories are people underweighting or overweighting? And that SBR, in my opinion, is like one of them, where people just don't care about it right now for whatever reason. And probably because of a lot of the boredom and the anger and the poor moods, right? Yeah. Like
the suite, I mean, it's definitely not, it's not a great performer for us. I mean, it got 184,000 views, but 478 likes, 61 retweets. But yeah, Scott Bessent was basically asked by Tim Scott, like, what's going on with all of our initiatives in the realm of Bitcoin and crypto? And Scott Bessent explicitly said, we're working on the strategic Bitcoin reserve. It's going to take time, but we want to do it right. Like, it's important. It's like signaling, like, no, we haven't forgotten about this. We're going to try and get a bill passed, which is incredibly bullish. And to your point, not many people covering it. And even when we covered it, yeah, 184,000 impressions is pretty good, but the engagement on the tweet itself is not as high as one might expect.
And it's like, if you post that same thing, man, in the middle of like a euphoric bull market, that thing's doing 10,000 likes, or if not more, whatever the number is. But it's just really interesting, because again, like the anger out there, you get the dumbest possible posts, people talking about Sailor blowing up. And that does crazy numbers because people are desperately looking for villains. Like, and not even just the broader public, but like Bitcoiners are looking for villains too, because they're angry about something. There's just this like residual emotional environment that's out there. And when stuff happens, like certain kinds of stories are more likely to latch on under those environments. And I think that lens is really interesting to me, where there's all these other positive movements too. Like Clarity Act is happening too. There's a lot of stuff I'm not always the biggest fan of in it, but like regardless, it's definitely this narrative that's really positive, right? And people are not caring about it quite as much because we're where we're at presently with moods. And that sort of those, it's always like the DV or the variance between them, right? That's the most interesting. It's not just like one single metric that's going to be useful, but like really looking at these and looking at them in the context of everything else is, to me, is the most fascinating stuff.
And so what do you think could be the catalyst for a sentiment shift here?
Or yeah,
what is needed for a sentiment shift?
So again, plebs are not very convicted right now. They're basically, another way to frame that is they're like looking for a story to latch onto. Because a new story that they can latch onto would allow them to have new conviction. Basically, humans are always looking for new stories to tell. We're always looking for a thing to latch onto to understand the world better. So stuff will come up. What that'll be, I have no idea yet. I'll for sure be watching it, because one of the interesting things is like seeing what early trends are starting to be talked about disproportionately. A really big trend was like the STRC thing, as like this perpetual buyer Bitcoin monetizing the bond market. That was a really big thing. I don't think that is done yet as a narrative. That one was very consistently growing over time. That's something. But sometimes narratives, like the relationship between price and narrative, is interesting too. Like narratives pop up because of price oftentimes, like don't necessarily lead it, you know. Like we're kind of looking for stories, not necessarily like finding them ahead of time. So it's always like a interesting thing there. Something else I will mention that's like kind of interesting to me here in this specific market dynamic is the 4-year cycle. So like we've talked about, like when stories are proven incorrect, it's really volatile, right? Because like it's a thing that we all locked onto as a truth that we were setting as like, this is our new barometer for how the world works. So to me, one of the interesting things right now is the 4-year cycle. We're like, everybody is super highly convicted the 4-year cycle is just not going to break. It's this like, reality. A lot of people are very convicted. So I haven't done this crazy deeply because I'm not quite as interested in the crypto space, but I did want to look at them a little bit to like see where the crypto folks were doing. They're doing terribly. Just really bad. It's hilarious. But a lot of those folks now are so convicted the 4-year cycle is just mathematically guaranteed that we're going to bottom in like October and then have another 4-year bull run. So to me, like this narrative is absolutely fascinating presently, where people are like pretty locked in that that's going to be the thing, right? So if anything happens where that narrative is like challenged at all, even if it's like, I'm not saying like we're going to like see a run up, like who knows? It's still like just this crazy, like there's so many things that can happen. All I'm saying is that if something does change here, if we do see any positive price action or even months from now, like before the 4-year cycle bottom should happen, if those things do start to happen, this narrative unravels very, 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 very quickly. Because normally when narratives are destroyed, there's volatility around them because people realize they were totally wrong, offsides, their view of the world was just incorrect. That is going to be so interesting to me, like watching the 4-year cycle narrative, like how it gets talked about more, when it gets talked about more, and the conviction around it specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, the 4-year cycle. I'm trying to think of like what... Because, I mean, I was, like I said, hand up. I was like, super cycle. I think the strategic reserve was like, governments are going to be buying. Like, we're done. Now it's like, all right, 4-year cycle. Saifedean Ammous was right. He's been talking about this publicly on X. I think he was one of the more level-headed Bitcoiners reacting last year. He was like, nope, I'm convinced the 4-year cycle is still a thing. We're gonna drift lower for the next year. And up to this point, that's proven to be true. And like you said, like some catalysts will emerge, will latch onto it, it'll It will confirm our priors, and the conviction will rise. I'm like, yeah, we were right. But I'm just trying to think of, like, the, again, going back to what I've been trying to do the last few weeks, like, is there any sort of consistent, persistent narrative catalyst that, or could there emerge a more persistent and consistent narrative that sort of does take us to, oh, Bitcoin's here, it's not going away, everybody needs to get some adoption, it's just going to experience an iPhone moment where it goes from this niche asset that a bunch of us crazy people are into, and some institutions and now nation states are as well, too. It becomes a, oh, you don't have Bitcoin, like, you have bad money, like, you need to get better money.
Sometimes I think it takes pain too, like the trucker protest being an example of that, where you, like, literally see people, like, use Bitcoin in a way that, like, nothing else could have solved, kind of thing. Like, sometimes it takes these negative events to prove out the underlying thesis and why that's so important. Sometimes it's not even necessarily a positive narrative. It's like a bad thing about money printing or, like, the way the government, like, our financial systems work. That's the thing that'll set people over the line. Cause, like, I don't have any charts of it, but one of the things I did look at was the phrase cold storage, and that being so much less of a primarily talked about thing than it was even back, like, a few years ago. But these properties of Bitcoin remain unchanged. And I'm certain that during specific regimes of, like, monetary like action by our governments, like, these things will come back again. Like, these properties are profoundly useful, but we kind of forget that at times, right? Especially, like, in a first world country like the US, like, it's just not as needed for a lot of people in the Bitcoin space. And they don't see that, but, like, there will be events that happen inevitably that prove out the value of this thesis once more, you know?
Yeah. It's like proof of keys day. Mm-hmm. Proof of keys day used to be a big thing until Trace Mayer left. Like, every January 3rd, people would go to their exchange and sweep the Bitcoin they had in the exchange to cold storage. And that narrative's completely died. I do think it's beginning to reemerge, but just from a different angle. Cause I think one of the points that's driving people towards anger is they believe a paper Bitcoin summer. And obviously the assumptions of paper Bitcoin are that there's rehypothecation going on. It's the largest buyers over the last 2-3 years are BlackRock on behalf of their customers and these treasury companies that are custodying at Coinbase. People are just running wild. Like, are they actually buying the Bitcoin? Is it there? And I think you're beginning to see a reemergence, at least from my sort of anecdotal observations, that people are coming back to, oh, you may need to put this in cold storage. And it's not because it's the safest way. It's because you need to sort of incite the bank run to unearth every hypothecation that may exist.
Yeah. See, the paper Bitcoin was a phrase I was super curious about, right? Like, it's definitely been a narrative popping up. The whole, like, paper Bitcoin really like took off in summer of 2025, like paper Bitcoin summer was a whole thing. But what I found interesting here was, like, it's really risen up more recently, but in a negative context. I have it labeled here, like, it really peaked as a narrative alongside higher levels of anger because people were looking for somebody to blame for stuff. This is not to say there is not some blame there. Like, there very well could be, there's for sure price manipulation happening out there, right? Especially because, like, in the paper Bitcoin markets, you're able to do these kinds of things. But it's kind of interesting to me that, like, the narratives come and go with the emotion, right? Like, it's not necessarily like, it's not always based on truth that stories arise. It's often based on, like, what people want to hear, what they're, like, looking for out there, right?
Yeah. No, you can see this resolving in many different ways. Like, right now, Stretch, I think it traded at, like, $91 over the weekend or late last week. I don't know where it is now, but it looks like it's drifting back to par. But you had this temporary 2-day sort of blow up on Twitter over the weekend. We're like, oh, Stretch is going to lose its peg. It's the next Terra Luna. It's going to blow up. It's going to be massive. Yeah, it's back at, like, almost $97. So, like, Stretch just reclaims the peg. It's like, yeah. Oh, well, no, maybe the mechanisms are working and this is a perpetual Bitcoin mining machine.
So this one's maybe been the most interesting narrative I've looked at. This is, yeah, Stretch talked about over time across the Bitcoin community. And you can see, like, when it came into existence in July or end of July, I think it was like literally like the last day, like the 31st or something. And then you can see it grow over time. But what's so interesting about it, in my opinion, is the variation, the volatility of the narrative, which is kind of a cool concept. Like, narratives are not always linear up and to the right. Like, there's a lot of up and down based on how news comes out, right? Stretch in general has been this like persistent and growing narrative over time. The first time I looked at this, it was just like so obviously up and to the right. It's been kind of falling off here more recently. But even still, it's like lower lows, higher highs generally when thinking about it. And it's kind of non-directional in a way, right? Like, it's not just that people are really euphoric about it. Like, but sometimes people are talking about it in a negative context, but still, like, all marketing is, or all PR is good PR, even if it's negative sometimes. Like, this is becoming a thing that people are talking about. And it's growing consistently. So, like, this is definitely, in my opinion, a narrative that's, it's not going anywhere, at least apparent anywhere right now. And this has been much more durable of a narrative compared to some other ones.
What are some other narratives that you're following that people may not be obvious to some people?
So it may not be obvious. Like, a lot of the ones are relatively obvious because it's like the ones that are talked about the most frequently are the interesting ones to look at. Quantum was one that I've looked at pretty closely because that also, like, so many of these actually have really similar chart dynamics where it's like, if it's in fearful negative, fearful narrative, they are up and to the right recently, really high mention rates. If it's a positive narrative, they are low currently. Clarity Act was another one that I looked at pretty closely. That's getting talked about more now, but like people are kind of underweighting generally. Stuff like recession, that as a word was interesting. There was like a couple spikes to talk about that. Things like MNAV over time, where people, like, you can really see the rate at which MNAV was talked about in these treasury companies, like, was blowing off right as well as all the euphoric MNAV valuations were. That was kind of a fun one. Yeah, I'm sort of all over the place with it because it's interesting to look at, and it's interesting to look how different groups talk about different things too. I don't have any charts with it to share today, but like MSTR as a narrative is talked about like 10x more in the like Bitcoin capitalist community that Saylor has coined compared to like the technologists or the fundamentalists. Just like different groups care about different things, latch onto different narratives. And like, especially because like we are all kind of siloed by our algorithms again. And like, despite trying to stay up to date with things, like, you probably have a better pulse on this than the vast majority of people, but like a lot of Bitcoiners are kind of in their own siloed algorithmic world and don't always have insight to what other groups are talking about. So it's really interesting now, like, seeing what other people are thinking about and when it's different from you. The capitalist group in general are actually very highly convicted right now, which is kind of another interesting thing.
Yeah. Do you think there's value? So I think I would fall into like the hardcore Bitcoin, like, technologist bucket. I think, because I talk about it a lot, and it's what I care about. And that's actually what interests me the most. But do you think, and I, to that point though, like, I do follow what's going on with Stretch, what's going on with MSTR, the MNAV conference. Like, I feel like, just due to the nature of what I do, I have to have a sort of well-rounded understanding of what's happening across the spectrum. But to your point, it's, these silos do exist. And do you think it would be beneficial for people in certain silos to really understand what's happening in the other silos? And if so, how do you do that?
That's already been one of the benefits to this for me, is like seeing what people are talking about and seeing how moods are different between them. Like the seeing the mood differences too between like the technologists and the fundamentalists and the capitalists has been like really interesting. You can really see like the moods are pretty poor generally among the more fundamentalist group of people, at least those in my system. I literally just did this weekend, so it's kind of new to me. I haven't explored it quite as deeply as some of the other ones, but like seeing how those things differ is fascinating. Another one is like BIP110. I specifically have cohorted the BIP110 users and how they're doing right now, and their moods are even worse than the plebs that we've looked at. They're like across the board, like anger, fear, less optimism, and lower conviction too. Just like the whole host of kind of like negative and then not convicted about stuff. Those sorts of things are interesting because, like, I am maybe not as plugged into some of these communities, but like seeing where they're at and where their specific sentiment is, that has been interesting to me to get a pulse for things too. Because, like, you can take what you want away from that. I know it's a pretty like charged topic, but that does give you a pretty good lens into how confident different groups are that their thing is a winning thing. Like the capitalists, on the other hand, are extremely confident and not necessarily always positively happy right now, but they're very high conviction that they are right. And that alone is like a very interesting takeaway in my opinion.
Yeah. No, the BIP 110, I can just tell from experience, they like to reply guy me and the TFTC account a lot because we're not as supportive as they would like us to be. And it's always very, very vulgar, very negative. I'm an enemy of Bitcoin now.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. And again, like people are looking for villains, right? Like it doesn't take much to become a villain when everybody's kind of pissed off.
Yeah, I'm just some guy who just doesn't agree with BIP 110. I'm a villain now. This is fascinating. What else can we pull from this? What else? What action should people take after listening to this episode?
Well, I think having continued conviction in Bitcoin right now would be maybe the one thing I'd like to leave people with. Like, it's so easy to get wrapped up in the more human side of stuff and like fall into whatever narrative's out there and fall into the fear that prices are down. But in my opinion, it's just like never been a better time to revisit the reasons you're here and double down on your conviction again. It's in times like these that really do separate people, right? Like now is the precise time you should be stacking. In the same way that like a James Check has the quartiles, like people are super pissed off right now. And like, rather than that be a reason for you to like get wrapped up in the anger and check out and get bored, like double down. Like now is a great time to buy Bitcoin. I am buying Bitcoin hard right now. Like I don't want to tell people what to do, but like to me, like kind of fading that. And like when you see anger and fear, I know it's like, it's like talking so much about negative emotions is not always this positive thing. But in my opinion, the takeaway is like, you should be freaking optimistic right now. Like this is exactly the things you would expect to see during bottoms. Like who knows what the price will do in the short term. I have no freaking clue, but this is your signal right here.
I think one thing we do have a clue of, we could say with a high degree of certainty, is that there's blood in the streets right now. And that's typically when the best buying opportunities arise. And again, we don't give financial advice on this show at all, but I think I concur with you that using my personal pattern recognition of sentiment over the years without the help of AI tools, but my own AI brain, my meat AI tool, that is my brain. It's one of those periods where it's like, yeah, everybody's pissed. Nobody's paying attention to Bitcoin because AI is taking the wind out of the sails. And those historically have been the best times to double down to your point. Where should I send people to find out more about your analysis?
Yeah. So the best way, I'm pretty active on X. My handle is Sully Michael, then like my name, but just inverted. And then I have a full archive of this work that I've been really pumping a lot more effort into on Substack, where you can just search my name, Michael Sullivan, and I do all sorts of stuff there and have a full, like, way in-depth versions of some of these charts, writings about them, videos about them, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll be sharing a lot more of my stuff over there, too.
Well, thank you for doing the work, sir. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating sociological dive into what's going on in the Bitcoin markets. And I've been loving watching you put out the charts and following it as you've been sort of iterating on the analysis and diving deeper into certain cohorts and basically surfacing what people are actually thinking right now. I think it's highly valuable data. And to your point earlier, it's like, it's not going to tell you when to buy or when we're going to bottom tick or top tick, but it'll help you out directionally, which I think is extremely valuable.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I'm thinking about it too.
Awesome. Well, Michael, this has been an absolute pleasure. We'll have to do this again at some point, catch up. If sentiment gets worse, if it gets better, I'm sure we'll have something to talk about. We'll be able to pick out narratives that arise and drive sentiment certain ways. That'll be a fun ongoing conversation.
Yeah, these things are a certainty. I guarantee you another story will evolve and become the thing. It always happens.
Ever. All right. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love.
Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time, and until next time.